Now, given its name, we shouldn't be surprised that this book of the Bible we're looking at features a lot of rulers. What else would you expect from a work entitled Kings? And that feature of the book, then, its preoccupation with monarchs, continues right until the very end, so that as we come to this final section this evening, these last two and a bit chapters, a fair amount of kingship is on display, and that then is reflected in my three headings this evening. They all contain that word kingship. And without further ado then, notice with me, first of all, the men intoxicated with kingship. The men intoxicated with kingship. So we encounter in this passage the end of Davidic monarchy. David's descendants inheriting David's rule, that reaches its expiry date here. Now, some of you may be narrowing your eyes and furrowing your brows at me saying that, and I know why that is. I know what you're thinking. But at this point in the sermon, I'm just going to leave that statement unqualified. We have here the end of Davidic monarchy. And as we read then about its last few representatives, this handful of kings with which the royal line of David ends, it can all be a bit confusing, can't it? In terms of names, things are somewhat confusing. King Jehoiakim's birth name is actually Eliakim. King Zedekiah's birth name is actually Mattaniah. So that's all somewhat mind-boggling. And then in terms of relationships, things here are a bit confusing too. What we have here actually are three different sons of Josiah reigning. Remember, we looked at King Josiah last time. He was a good king. Well, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah, they are all his sons. There is a grandson of Josiah's who also reigns briefly here, Jehoiakim. But it's a strange period, this, in which despite the number of different kings, there isn't much generational advance, if you like. Most of these rulers are just brothers, or half-brothers, at the least. So I hope you're not too thrown, then, by all these confusing names and confusing relationships. But it's one recurring phenomenon with these men that I really want to draw your attention to. Of course, their reigns are all summed up by that damning adjective, evil. Each one did, we are told, what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. No doubt a reference to both religious and moral conduct. In the religious realm, these last kings of Judah promoted idol worship, no doubt. In the moral realm, they probably chased after wine, women, and wealth, and happily shed the blood of innocent men and women. But none of that is the recurring phenomenon that I'm talking about. There's another one that we see with these men, and it's this: rebelling against Babylonian rule. That tendency keeps rearing its head with these men. Rebelling against Babylonian rule. So Jehoiakim, we read in chapter 24, verse 1, that having initially submitted to Babylonian rule and maintained that stance, in fact, for 3 years, he then withdrew that submission. He rebelled, we're told. Similarly, Zedekiah, there's that dramatic last line of chapter 24. Verse 20 there, Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. So Jehoiakim and Zedekiah both rebel, and then someone else does too, someone who isn't actually a king of Judah, but who probably sees himself as one. I'm talking about Ishmael, who features there in chapter 25, verses 22 to 26. Now, he's an army captain, but we're told significantly there in verse 25 of chapter 25, he's of the royal family. He's Davidic. He's of the royal family. And probably he thinks, therefore, that he has a right to rule, or a greater right, at least, than this governor, Gedaliah. And so he kills Gedaliah. But killing Gedaliah, crucially, is more than just a petulant act by this descendant of David who feels that he should be ruling. It's rebelling against the Babylonians, because they've appointed Gedaliah. They've appointed Gedaliah to preside over those who are left now in Judah following the mass deportation of Jews to Babylon. And so Ishmael here is being brazenly defiant when he kills Gedaliah. So he isn't in exactly the same category as Jehoiakim and Zedekiah. They are actual kings of Judah. Ishmael is a wannabe king of Judah. But like those actual kings, I'm saying, he too rebels against Babylonian rule. So you can see then, I hope, that this is indeed a recurring phenomenon, this rebelling against Babylonian rule. What should we make of that? Well, at a purely pragmatic level, it's stupid. Babylon by now is a massive superpower. I mean, you get hints of that throughout our passage, chapter 24, verse 7. The king of Egypt did not come again out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt. Now, Egypt was a pretty powerful nation in itself. And yet, Egypt now is completely in subjection to Babylon. Or chapter 24, verse 2, you have that interesting thing there where Jehoiakim, as we've already said, has rebelled against Babylonian rule. And then we read that all these bands of Syrians and Moabites and Ammonites come against Judah. What's the connection? He's rebelled against Babylon, and the Syrians, the Moabites, and the Ammonites come against him. Well, these nations are all vassals to Babylon. And so it's the king of Babylon, it's the Lord ultimately, we're told, but the king of Babylon sends the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Syrians against Judah, because they're all in his pocket. They're all under his control. Or chapter 25, verse 28, right at the end of our whole passage, and we'll come back to that conclusion later. But we're told there of there being lots of kings in Babylon, kings of all these different ancient Near Eastern lands, because they've all been brought under subjection to Babylon. So I'm saying it's a massive superpower. And so rebelling against it on the part of Judah, little Judah, it's only going to lead to disaster. And indeed it does in each of these cases. I mean, Ishmael's rebellion against Babylonian rule is especially senseless and counterproductive. Senseless because there is no Judah left by this point. Judah has gone into exile. I mean, can't Ishmael see it's all over? The game is up. There's no way back. Why is he even still rebelling against the Babylonians? And counterproductive, because all it achieves in verse 26 of chapter 25 is making Judah's exile even more total. So that even those who are left now all get up and run off to Egypt. So at a purely pragmatic level, the rebellion of these men against Babylonian rule is stupid. But it's worse than that. Being under Babylonian rule is God's punishment. It's God's punishment against Judah. As readers, we know that. I mean, look at chapter 24, verse 3, where we're told this came upon Judah at the command of the Lord, because of sins. We know that as readers, and these kings themselves should have known it. Because for decades now, the prophets had been talking about it. Remember right the way back in Manasseh's reign, back in chapter 21, verse 14, God was saying there, I'm going to forsake the remnant of my heritage and give them into the hand of their enemies. And so it should have been obvious to these men that being now under Babylonian rule, it wasn't just some random political development. It was God's punishment against them for sins. And if being under Babylonian rule is divine punishment, then at the very least, it should have been obvious that rebellion was futile. But more than that, being under Babylonian rule should therefore have prompted repentance. rather than rebellion. It shouldn't have made them think Nebuchadnezzar is a nasty oppressor whose control we need to resist. It should have made them think Yahweh is an offended God whose mercy we need to plead. But neither pragmatic nor those deeper considerations seem to have entered these kings' brains. They rebel against Babylonian rule. Why? Why did they think that they could possibly pull it off? These rulers in little Judah, why did they possibly think that it was worthwhile and realistic to rebel against mighty Babylon? Well, this is where my heading comes in. They must have been, it seems to me, intoxicated with kingship. Intoxicated with the supposed power and invincibility of kingship. I mean, the role of king of Judah may not have had the same prestige now that it had had in earlier days, but it still came with a palace and servants and an eminent standing within society. And all of that could go to a man's head and kind of detach him from reality. And you know, you don't have to belong to the house of David back then in ancient history to slip into an illusion of power and invincibility and become intoxicated with it. It can happen still. It can happen to Christians, especially Christians who have positions of leadership within the church. Pray for the leaders of this church, for the leaders of NREC, that they will always be men who, in Paul's language, don't think of themselves more highly than they ought to think. Pray that the leaders in this church will be protected by God's grace from ever throwing their weight around. Pray that the leaders in this church will never be the victims of this kind of intoxication with their position that we see in these last kings of Judah. But it isn't just Christians in positions of leadership. We all need to beware this. Think again of the precise situation here in our passage. God sends the Babylonians Judah's way, which should have prompted repentance. But instead, these men are self-sufficient. I'll handle this, is their attitude. And there are times when in our Christian lives, God sends trials our way, which should prompt not always repentance perhaps, but certainly a real humility and dependence on God. And yet it's possible for us in those situations to respond instead like these kings in a self-sufficient way. I think that's an important point. We generally think, don't we, of trials. In our theological categories, we generally think of trials as the antidote to proud self-sufficiency. That's the only role that trials can possibly perform. They wean us away from proud self-sufficiency and they make us cast ourselves upon God. And truly, trials can do that. And often perhaps do that. But they don't automatically do that. And they don't inevitably do that. Listen to Joel Beakey. He writes, pride feeds off nearly anything. And then he gives a few things. A fair measure of ability and wisdom. Pride can feed off that. A single compliment. A season of remarkable prosperity. A call to serve God in a position of prestige. And then this. Even the honor of suffering. Pride can feed even off the honor of suffering. As I say, we tend to think of suffering as the thing that always kills pride, but not necessarily, Joel Beakey is saying. Suffering itself can fuel pride. Suffering itself can be the thing off which our pride feeds. feeds. So subtle and devious and deeply rooted is our proud self-sufficiency. Think of it this way. Consider Paul's famous words, "I can do all things." They're in Philippians 4. Now, in the face of some trial or other that has come our way, there's a right way of saying those words, "I can do all things," and there's a wrong way of saying those words, "I can do all things." The right way is by adding onto them what Paul adds onto them. "I can do all things through him who strengthens me." The wrong way is by not adding onto them those words, "I can do all things through him who strengthens me." So that "I can do all things" just becomes this self-sufficient cry. I've got it covered. I'm a mature, experienced Christian. I'll cope with this trial. It'll take more than this to floor me. That's uncomfortably close to the stance of these men here in our passage. May God protect us all from that kind of foolish intoxication with our supposed power and invincibility. And so that's the first thing then for us to notice in our passage, the men intoxicated with kingship. But then notice secondly, the realities fencing in kingship. The realities fencing in kingship. And so I want to now shift our focus to a different king altogether here in this passage. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, is one formidable guy, isn't he, here in our passage? I mean, we've already talked about the formidableness of the Babylonian superpower in general at this historical juncture. But as for Nebuchadnezzar, well, he's just this towering figure over the whole Babylonian enterprise. Look at chapter 24, verses 10 to 16. And there then, we're told in verse 10 that the servants of Nebuchadnezzar came and besieged Jerusalem. But that doesn't seem at that point to cause too much of a problem. But then we read in the next verse, and Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. And it's at that point that everything kicks off and things really start to happen. And you read those verses and it's just the king did this and the king did that and the king did the next thing. Nebuchadnezzar just rampaging through Jerusalem, doing exactly whatever he wants to do. Or chapter 25, verses 6 and 7. Those sobering verses about Zedekiah. They captured the king, that's King Zedekiah, and brought him to the king of Babylon at Riblah. And so under his supervision, under Nebuchadnezzar's supervision, Zedekiah's sons are slaughtered. And then, having seen that final image with his eyes, Zedekiah's eyes are gouged out. And it's all under Nebuchadnezzar's supervision there at Riblah. Or then chapter 25, verses 18 to 21, where a whole bunch of significant Jerusalem figures are captured, and again they're taken out to Nebuchadnezzar at Riblah again. And we read in verse 21 that this time he himself does the dirty deed. The king of Babylon struck them down and put them to death at Riblah in the land of Hamath. He is one formidable man, and it just seems then as if there are no boundaries to what he can do. The sky is the limit. Indeed, this king can even humble Yahweh itself, Yahweh himself. There's a great emphasis, isn't there, on what he does to the Jerusalem temple. To be sure, he does things to Jerusalem's palace and houses and walls as well. That's all mentioned, but only in a brief and perfunctory way. The same isn't true when it comes to the temple. As I say, there's a great emphasis on what Nebuchadnezzar does to the temple. It's more than just burned, like all those other buildings in the city. It's ransacked. Chapter 24, verse 13. He carried off all the treasures of the house of the Lord. He cut in pieces all the vessels of gold in the temple of the Lord. And then chapter 25, verses 13 to 17, a long list of all the the gold and the silver and the bronze that Nebuchadnezzar ransacked from Jerusalem's temple and took away with him. And notice that the connection this building has to Yahweh is really, really stressed in our text. Five times it's referred to as the house of Yahweh. Once it's referred to as the temple of Yahweh. And you can imagine then Nebuchadnezzar's satisfaction, can't you? As he issued his instructions to Nebuzaradan, the captain of his bodyguard. As he sent Nebuzaradan off to ransack Yahweh's temple. You can imagine how that's really massaged Nebuchadnezzar's ego. This God of Judah, he might be able to dry up the Red Sea if all those ancient legends are really true. But he's no match for me. It's time for all his treasures to be put into my hands. Thank you very much. It's time now for Yahweh to decrease and for Nebuchadnezzar to increase. And that's why I say then he can even humble Yahweh himself. Or can he? Or can he? Is his kingship, which seems on the face of things just, as I say, so free and unconstrained and unrestricted and unfettered, is his kingship really as free and unconstrained as that? And the answer is no. This apparent humbler of God himself is actually fenced in. And he's fenced in then by these three realities. Notice, first of all, he's merely useful. Nebuchadnezzar, he's merely useful. You see, the irony is that as he thinks he's asserting his superiority over Yahweh, pulling down brick by brick Yahweh's house, he's actually only doing Yahweh's will. He's fulfilling Yahweh's purpose. He's being Yahweh's instruments. You see, the destruction of the temple isn't really Nebuchadnezzar defeating Yahweh. That's what it looked like to him, no doubt. That's what it might have looked like to any observer in the ancient Near East. But the destruction of the temple isn't really Nebuchadnezzar defeating Yahweh. It's really Yahweh punishing his people, whose greatest privilege is to have his house in their midst, and commandeering Nebuchadnezzar as his means of doing it. Chapter 24, verse 13. One very significant line there. We're told about all that Nebuchadnezzar did and how he cut in pieces all the vessels of gold in the temple of the Lord, which Solomon, king of Israel, had made. And then that line, as Yahweh had foretold. This isn't Yahweh being defeated by Nebuchadnezzar. This is Nebuchadnezzar doing Yahweh's work for him. He's merely useful, this king. But not only that, not only is he merely useful, he's eventually helpless. He's eventually helpless. It's interesting what we're told about Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 25, verse 27. And you'll look at that verse now and you'll say, no, Dan, we're told nothing about Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 25, verse 27. All we're told there is about Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon. Well, that's the point. What we are told about Nebuchadnezzar in that verse is that he's merely mortal. Evil-Merodach is now king of Babylon because Nebuchadnezzar is dead. And buried. He's gone. This man who can supposedly humble Yahweh himself is actually a blip on the radar of history which flashes briefly and is then gone. He thinks that he can subdue the God of Israel. He can't even subdue his own body. He can't even bring it under control. He can't stop some cancer getting into his bones, or some infection getting into his lungs, or some disease getting into his heart, or whatever it was that finally killed Nebuchadnezzar. He can't stop it happening. He's helpless in the face of death. He can pull buildings down. He can carry treasures away. He can't hold death at bay. I'm saying there are these realities that actually are fencing this man in. He's not the free man that he appears to be. He's merely useful. He's eventually helpless. And then one more thing, he's utterly outdone. He's utterly outdone. Because while then he dies, as we've just said, the God whom he has humbled doesn't die. He lives on and on. And still in 2023, he lives on. And in fact, his temple is now in 2023 grander than ever. Constructed, as the Apostle Peter tells us, of living stones. It now stretches right across this planet. This temple destroyer, Nebuchadnezzar, is a largely forgotten footnote in history now. Yahweh, on the other hand, is adding more and more stones to his enormous temple. Stones from China and Ethiopia and Nepal and Brazil and Romania and South Korea and Bangladesh and myriad other places. Even, in fact, Nebuchadnezzar's own backyard, Babylon, present-day Iraq and Syria. Who's humble now? The man who has a few references to him in the British Museum, which school children walk past, barely noticing every day of the week. He's the one humbled now. Not this God, Yahweh, who has been worshipped across more and more of planet Earth. So these three realities are actually fencing this man in very significantly. He's merely useful. He's eventually helpless. He's utterly outdone. And in fact, those three realities, you know, they fence in every human ruler. However formidably opposed a human ruler may be to the living God. And there are Nebuchadnezzars in our world today, aren't there? There are powerful regimes and powerful rulers who are full of sound and fury in their opposition to the living God. And they seem, like Nebuchadnezzar perhaps, just limitless in their capacity to damage God's cause. They're fenced in the same way that Nebuchadnezzar was. They are merely useful. God is simply employing them at the end of the day to fulfill his purposes. They are eventually helpless. Death will claim them, and they won't be able to resist it any more than Nebuchadnezzar could. And they are utterly outdone because their empires and projects ultimately pale into insignificance alongside God's global church building extravaganza. Be comforted and encouraged by that in our world of apparently powerful Nebuchadnezzars this evening. So the men intoxicated with kingship, the realities fencing in kingship, and then one last thing, the God committed to kingship. The God committed to kingship. The final scene of our passage and of this book is fascinating, isn't it? Fascinating partly because of the reappearance of Jehoiakim. He was taken off to Babylon in chapter 24, verse 15, and now here suddenly at the end he reappears there in Babylon. Fascinating partly because he's in this position of supremacy suddenly over lots of other kings in Babylon. And fascinating most of all because he's still identified here as the king of Judah. Do you notice that? Twice in this final paragraph, that is what he's called. He's Jehoiakim, king of Judah. It seems so bizarre. There aren't kings of Judah anymore. There haven't been for decades. Judah's gone. Judah's throne is gone. And yet here, Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Jehoiakim, king of Judah. How can there suddenly be a king of Judah again? Well, perhaps similar questions to those that swirl around our minds as we read this last paragraph. Perhaps similar questions race through someone else's mind many years later. The mind of a young woman being addressed by an angel, no less, and being told by that angel that she's going to have a child. A child who will be given the throne of his father, David. It's there in Luke chapter 1, verse 32. The young woman, of course, is Mary. And among many other questions then, like how on earth am I going to have a child when I'm an unmarried virgin? Among many other questions swirling around her mind as she hears that message from the angel, must have been this one. How is this child of mine going to reign on David's throne? There is no such throne now. You don't get Davidic kings anymore. That all finished centuries ago, angel. But of course, the angel was right. With Mary's child, the royal line of David was going to emphatically reappear, indeed reach the very goal for which it existed in the first place. And I think then that this little reappearance here in our passage, here at the end of 2 Kings 25, is a faint hint. It's just sowing in readers' minds as this book closes and everything just seems so, so bleak. It's sowing in readers' minds this thought, don't write off Davidic kingship. It can suddenly come out of the woodwork at the most surprising points and in the most surprising places. In Babylon, at the dining table of some random ruler, Davidic kingship suddenly reappears. And if there, why not in other unexpected situations? Like an obscure Galilean town called Nazareth, at the height of Rome's domination of the world and in the womb of some young girl. You see, God may bring the royal line of David to an abrupt halt in 587 BC because of his wrath provoked by Manasseh. That's what we read in chapter 24, verses 3 and 4. But long before Manasseh, God had promised that the royal line of David would never end. In 2 Samuel 7, through the prophet Nathan, you remember, addressing David, God had promised there that the royal line of this man, David, would never end. And therefore, God, because of that promise through Nathan to David, God is immovably committed to kingship, to Davidic kingship. And even dire episodes like Manasseh's reign and all that happens here in our passage this evening, it won't stop him keeping those prior gracious promises. Yes, it's all scary stuff. Manasseh rebelling so grievously. And all that happens here as the Davidic kingship just seems to disappear into the sand. It's all sobering and serious, but there are prior gracious promises of God that the Davidic line will last forever. And nothing is going to stop God keeping those promises. And I just want to close then converting that into a personal principle. A principle for us as individuals this evening. You see, at your conversion, you received promises. Precious and very great promises, as Peter calls them in 2 Peter 1 verse 4. That's what Paul means. Do you remember how he says in Romans 8, verse 24? He's been talking about future glory, and he says that in this hope you were saved. So at your conversion, you Romans, he's saying, you inherited all these promises about future glory. That's what you get at conversion. You get these promises of immense, magnificent future glory when Jesus returns, the resurrection, the new earth, all that stuff. But since then, since your conversion, perhaps there have been some pretty dire episodes in your life. Times of backsliding. Times of drift. Times of appalling falls into sin. And perhaps, although you've to some degree come back from all that, you've repented, perhaps there's still a nagging thought somewhere in your head. You're wondering if perhaps those dire episodes somehow override the promises. The promises that you received at conversion, that you grabbed with both hands at conversion. Promises of a wonderful future. Perhaps those things you've done, those places you've been, those situations you've plunged into since conversion, perhaps they override the promises. And I'm saying to you tonight, no. In that clash between his prior gracious promises and your dire episodes, the former wins. The promises win. That's what our passage is pointing to, I think, because it ends with a Davidic king suddenly reappearing. It's saying God's promises win. God's promise, this line will go on. And there's a whole load of mess that seems to have the potential to obliterate that promise. But no, the promise wins. The promise always wins. There's a stubborn relentlessness about God's gracious promises. You're on the beach and there's a stream flowing down the beach into the sea, and you try to dam it with sand and you can't do it. You can't stop that stream flowing. The sand just disintegrates and dissolves, and the stream carries on to the sea, and your sin and your foolishness can't obstruct God's mighty promises any more than your sandy dam can obstruct that stream. The promises find a way through and they will reach fulfillment. And be encouraged if you're worried tonight that you've messed up at some points in your Christian life too much. You stepped over a line where you're beyond the reach of the promises anymore. No, God's promises are stubbornly relentless. And they will win. Be comforted tonight, Christian believer. Amen.